the nearshoring opportunity is so strong that even if Mexico does a very poor job, it's going to be great.
Hello and welcome to the INSEAD Emerging Markets Podcast, where we interview business leaders and emerging market experts on business innovations, market opportunities, and macro-level trends in emerging and frontier market countries. Join us for the next hour to dive deep into the world of emerging markets as we speak with top performers who are successfully investing, working, and living in these markets themselves. Welcome to the INSEAD Emerging Markets Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Lal, and I'm here today with Jorge Gonzalez-Henriksen. Jorge is co-CEO of The Nearshore Company. The Nearshore Company helps North American, European, and Asian manufacturing companies to successfully establish reliable manufacturing operations in Mexico by ensuring quality certifications, transparency, and continuous improvement. Jorge is a leading voice on nearshoring and globalization, and he's been featured in publications such as Forbes, the BBC, Sourcing Journal, Supply and Demand Chain Executive, and FreightWaves. Jorge is also a professor of entrepreneurship at the Instituto Tecnológico Autónomo de México and managing partner of Acacia Capital Partners, where he focuses on acquiring and growing middle market companies. So really excited to have you on the podcast today. I'm really looking forward to learning more about nearshoring from you as it's very topical, of course. Mexico has just overtaken China as the top exporter to the U.S. But before we get into what your company does and nearshoring, though, I'd love to learn a little bit more about your personal background. From what I know, you didn't start the nearshore company. You actually came in later and were part of the acquisition. So would love to learn a bit more about that whole process. I mean, I know that you got your MBA from Stern back in 2009, but then it was another 10 years or so before you came to the nearshore company. So maybe if you could just briefly tell me what got you interested in entrepreneurship, specifically entrepreneurship through acquisition, and then how you eventually landed on the nearshore company as the target that you wanted to run. I think that would be a great place for us to start.
Sure, Nick. Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. I think it's a great opportunity to get other would-be entrepreneurs interested in the path, specifically ETA. We will talk about that. And on the nearshoring piece, I think it's incredible how this has taken off. Incredible for Mexico, for us and the company, and for myself as an entrepreneur. So I'll start way back saying that I studied international relations in college, and this is the first time in my career that I'm able to apply what I learned, because when I just graduated from international relations, I didn't know what it was for. All that I studied and all that I read, I was like, where am I going to use all these ideas that I learned? And that all made sense with the nearshore company. I was born and raised in Mexico City. I went to college in Mexico City. And as I was saying, when I graduated, I said, I need to get a real job. And I don't know if it was the right call, but I went into investment banking because it was the thing to do if you wanted to do something hardcore. And in my mind, I'll really learn how to work with the big boys here. And I actually got what I asked for, painfully, because I don't know if I would do it again. Those long nights and weekends and all that stuff. And I was there for 4 years in investment banking. And then I left to get my MBA at NYU Stern, a very financial-oriented school. And naturally and unoriginal, I thought of going into private equity or hedge funds as my next step. With entrepreneurship always in the back of my mind, really, but without a clear idea on what would I do as an entrepreneur. You know, I think this is very common. No? People are attractive to the potential upside financially of being an entrepreneur, of this perception that you can control your destiny and your time and your resources, but not really clear on the immediate path. No, what's that great idea? And so that was holding me back. I graduated in 2009 in the middle of the financial meltdown.
Not the best time.
So you can imagine my plans to go into private equity and hedge funds disintegrated, as did for more than half of my graduating class. But the silver lining here is that I went back to Mexico and I got a job at a big group that had a restaurant chain division. And I had studied with one of the members of the family that were their controlling shareholders in graduate school. We met at the MBA at Stern. And he actually told me, well, if you're looking for something more management-oriented, but also with finance, we're looking to really turn this business around. It was a company that opened its doors in the 60s. And at that moment, it had about 150 full-service restaurants publicly listed in Mexico. But they really wanted to modernize things. And for me, it was in my mind kind of like, well, this is sort of what I was thinking when I thought of private equity. And so I did that, and I was there for 5 years as CFO. And it was my first real encounter with management, real management. You know, investment banks have very little people, highly specialized in technical people like consulting. But this is a company now that had 7,000 employees, right? And so I really got a taste of management. And I said, well, you know, I like it. I like management more than financial services. And after, again, 5 years there, I figured, well, I'm still sort of young. I was my 33 or 34, something like that. Why don't I go out and I look for a smaller company than this one? I get some investors and I apply my newly minted managerial skill and I run it in exchange for some sweat equity, right? And now that I think, I mean, whenever I say this, people say, well, that's a search fund. But I didn't know it at the time because the search fund, at least at that time, still remained pretty clubby, you know, with Harvard and Stanford calling the shot in the industry. And I had never heard of the search fund. So when I started to share with my personal network what I wanted to do, eventually someone told me, well, you want to do a search fund? What's that? Read the primer, the GSB primer. And it happens to 99% of the people that read the primer for the first time, they're like, this is what I want to do. I didn't know this existed. Now that I know, I want to do it. And that's how I started to knock on doors of at the time, and many of them still exist, but the famous or the known investors in search funds. And also the investors in search funds that are already invested in Mexico. So I knew they wanted more Mexico on their portfolio. Mm. And so in less than 5 months, I remember I raised about $450,000 and I had my search fund. At that time, it was called Sabino Equity Partner. And it was a Mexico-focused search. And I was on my own. No search partner. So yeah, that's how it started. Everybody says this, I have a unique path in the search fund world, not only because I started older than most of the people that do search fund, but also because with Sabino Equity Partners, I didn't buy a company. I searched for 3 years. I still remember the stats. I placed 22 LOIs. I reached out to over 500 companies. I had 4 due diligence processes, and they all fell through. And so at the end, by this time, I was already a father of 2 kids. And I said, you know what? My wife had been very patient.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? I don't know if I want to keep going or I need to take some air. And I decided that I wasn't going to raise more money because some investors want it. They're like, you know what? It happens. Continue. And I said, you know what? I'm not thinking clearly anymore. I need some time. And I took some time off, a couple of weeks, I still remember. And when I came back, I said, I tried, and 3 years is enough. And one of my investors actually made me an offer to work at one of his companies, business units that was starting off. And then she had told me, you know what? I don't want my management team to get distracted by this. This is what I think you like. I liked how you ran Sabino. And I took this job. And again, it had a manufacturing angle. It was building materials, and I was in charge for the first time of a manufacturing facility, plus all the other stuff from production to sales and marketing. And as luck would have it.
And this was also in Mexico.
And I'm building up to reach the nearshoring company. Don't worry, I'll soon get there, but I think this is important to mention. One of my investors who had seen all the process, he was a junior partner of a private equity fund in Mexico for more than 10 years. He calls me one day and he says, well, you know, I want to start a search fund. And I think, well, this is strange though. Like you're private equity and you got this thesis that can talk about that later on the emerging markets part. You know, private equity in Mexico has been extremely challenging to say the least and actually unattractive at some point that he decides to leave the fund and start this project. And he does start it with another partner. also from the fund, but I helped them a lot. And in this process of introducing them to the community of search funds, helping them to vet deals, kind of act like as a sounding board, at some point they find this amazing company in northern Mexico on the border, because their thesis was border businesses that sell in U.S. dollars but have Mexico costs. And remember, at that time, we had a brand new president in 2018, López Obrador. There was a lot of talk in the country of where is the country going, where is it, you know. So this was a kind of like defensive play. But one of the two partners didn't want to move to that side of the border with Texas, right? So they started to have this constant argument, and they break up. And one of them kind of keeps the deal and tells me, you know what, I still want to do it, but I want a partner. Do you want to join my fund, which is Acacia Capital Partners? And long story short, I said yes. And that's how I joined my second search fund, but this time already with a deal that was already on the table. So actually it was more about getting the deal closed and running the company. And that's how I joined Acacia. This company used to be International Assemblies, now the Nearshore company. Yeah. And that, so that's the path from college in Mexico City to the Nearshore company in Brownsville, Texas.
Sure. And how soon after acquisition did you change the name? And what was the thinking behind that rebranding of the company?
The name International Assembly had its own problems in my mind. One of them being because it was International Assembly, Inc. And a lot of people talked about the company as IAI. The company was founded in 1992. So this is 27 years of people saying IAI. But the thing is that it was now an LLC. So people say, what's IAI? Well, International Assembly LLC. So that was even kind of like a mismatch now. The second part, and this was brought to our attention by a marketing expert, is the word international is really nice when you're looking for an exotic vacation. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that you want to hear when you're going to send your family business to another country. And the third part was the logo. The logo was IAI in Greek letters, like a fraternity, and with a baby blue color. That honestly was pretty best. And so I would say we bought the company in September of 2019. We still didn't do anything about the name or the logo for about a year. And then starting 2020, so this is a pandemic, one of the things as many companies did was we became more introspective. No? This was a time to think of our strategy more, of how, what can we improve. Trade shows were closed. You couldn't visit clients. So it was, again, it was at that time. It's pretty weird when you look back, but. And we hired this marketing firm and we said, well, we need to change the name. We need to rebrand. And after a lot of workshops and interviews with our clients, the name Nearshore hit the table. When we first saw it, honestly, we were a bit skeptical because we had all on the leadership team heard the term Nearshore, but it was software related, not manufacturing. So we really had to kind of dig the internet and our industry to get comfortable with it. And we did. We took it to the board. They had a similar reaction. And at the end, they said, well, we're going to trust you guys as the operating partners. And we said, we're going to trust the marketing expert. And we went forward with it. And we were very, very lucky because we never imagined the term Nearshore to pick up as strong as it did for manufacturing. I mean, to the point that a lot of times we go to a trade show nowadays and people think, oh, these guys just opened the company 3 months ago because of the Nearshoring buzz. And we have to explain that we're an old company with a new name. And so, yeah, that's the story of the name. And now it really saves a lot of time in explaining what we do.
I mean, it's pretty much the perfect name for a company doing what you do these days. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty prescient. One question going back to the acquisition, from what I know about search funds it seems that investors typically prefer more asset-light businesses that don't require a lot of technical knowledge just because it minimizes risk, especially if you're bringing in a more inexperienced CEO. I was wondering if it was due to your background in manufacturing that it became a more attractive target, or were there already attributes of the business that made it okay for your partner and the investors prior to bringing you into the company?
You're right, Nick. Search funds typically have a scorecard of what they're looking for based on experience of successful search funds. And it does not include fixed asset companies like a manufacturing firm. And in our case, it's important to mention that 80% of the company is actually a service company. And actually manufacturing, as many people imagine it, with bricks and mortars and fixed assets, is really about 20% of our business. And that happens because in 80% of our company, we are signing a service agreement, more like a BPO service, to a manufacturing company, let's say in the U.S., and they send their equipment to a facility in Mexico, a facility that we lease for them, with employees that we hire for them, with raw material that we import for them. But they are the ones that have the machinery on their books because they are the ones that manufacture. Mm. And we lease the building, so we don't have real estate either. So we are an asset-light model at our core. The other 20% that we do manufacture, we have equipment, we do purchase inventory. It is really something that a lot of our investors at the beginning didn't like. They were like, what are you going to do with that 20 or 15% of the business? Are you going to sell it? Are you going to keep it? And to your point about our profiles, it did help that we were both older and more mature and had managed asset-heavy businesses. That helped. At least in saying, you know what, let's go through with this and we're going to see what we do as we get to know the business better. And you know what, we've kept it because our business is difficult. It's not very easy to differentiate when you're just talking about this service component, right? I mean, you can do excellent service, but in order to get a higher differentiation, we have capitalized on our manufacturing expertise that other service providers don't have. So we have a team of engineers, we have a team of quality that are doing manufacturing for us. And so when we go out to the market and pitch what we do, it has become an asset to say, well, we are a manufacturing company like you. And if you have any issues, we have engineers, we have people that repair equipment. We have certifications in a lot of manufacturing, ISOs, IATF for automotive, et cetera. And so we have kept that division. And it hasn't grown as strong as the service one, but it's more of a maintenance type of growth that we have there. So,
yeah. Sure. Yeah. Given the circumstances, I'm sure there are a lot of these sort of concierge services popping up. But with your technical know-how and being able to point to actually doing work in manufacturing, I'm sure that's a huge value add and differentiator. I'm curious how things have changed. I mean, there's been a lot of talk of nearshoring since U.S.-China trade war, and then ever since then, there's just been more and more talk of that. So I was curious, who are your clients and how do they find you? And has that changed a lot since you took over back in 2019?
Our investment thesis has not changed. So even when we were raising money to close the deal, our pitch was centered around there should be more manufacturing coming from Asia to Mexico because China is not what it used to be. Also, there should be more U.S. companies that when they're thinking of where do I go for the first time, they're probably going to think of Mexico more than the past 20 years when it was China or China. And one was also we were looking at trends. We were looking at reports by consulting firms. I remember a BCG report talking about this with a lot of data why Mexico and the U.S. together would be the champions going forward in manufacturing. You already start to hear Trump with the discourse that China had not been playing by the rules. In fact, this is something that even since Clinton, he was already saying that, right? And since then, I mean, it was everybody. It's one of those things that it everybody says, like, well, someone do something about it. Like, you know, everybody knew the Chinese government was heavily subsidizing these companies, heavily impacting the FX rate to make their exports more attractive. Like, everybody knew that this was happening. And we're saying, well, this is eventually going to blow up. What we never imagined, because if we had it, we wouldn't be where we are. We would be having a coffee with Warren Buffett. It's, I mean, the pandemic is what really made our investment thesis. It put us on a rocket. And that's something that we never thought. But the thesis is the same. It's just the speed and the intensity that has really changed. Because when I say the pandemic, it's a lot of factors that happened at the same time. You know, it's one of those very academic correlation versus causation discussions that I probably don't want to get into. But when you look at it from what I call a cocktail perspective, it is incredible. I mean, you had the U.S. and China fighting, and I'm bundling there the Trump tariffs as part of that fight. And as a result of that fight, they're starting to talk about decoupling. You know, let's decouple these countries that are so connected. No? But then you cut the pandemic at the same time, in which everybody said, like, oh my God, supply chains are not as rock solid as I thought they were, because I just put buy and I get my Amazon product in 2 days. Nobody really thinks what's behind that. And now people were starting to think, because we go to the supermarket and you don't have things there. So this fear of these long supply chains and the just-in-time model. But then also, again, you have this Russia invasion of Ukraine. And suddenly the world seems not as friendly and as flat as that. I remember, I forgot the name of the author, The World is Flat. And suddenly this regionalization of the world starts to come back with a vengeance after so many years of only global and global and global and global. And then you had that Suez Canal boat that got stuck, I remember at that time. And then to put a cherry on top, and this is what really put the whole thing even exploded, is the labor shortages in the U.S. That is really a demographic issue that is not going to get fixed from one day to the next, because the only way to get hundreds of thousands of 25-year-olds is to wait 25 years. And so there's no way. We haven't figured out how to clone people yet. And so you got all this at the same time. And what this happened is that suddenly Mexico becomes this country, neighbor to the U.S., that had always been there, but nobody was paying attention. And now all of a sudden they're like, hey, why don't we manufacture in Mexico then? Because that way we're going to get rid of a lot of this risk. And by the way, Mexico has a young population and most of it pretty skilled, at least at the labor-intensive manufacturing jobs. And they're willing to work. And by the way, it's cheaper than China now, you know? And so Mexico, since NAFTA, had been doing its homework. We have signed something around 14 free trade agreements. We already had a very strong automotive industry and aerospace and medical devices. Mexico had moved from an oil-dependent economy to a manufacturing one in this time, since the early 90s. And so suddenly when the U.S. looks at Mexico, it's like, hey, these guys are not that bad. Like, we were so focused on China. And so, yeah, addressing your specific question, we did start to hear the phone ring a lot. And it also, I mean, we also got better marketing and website sales. And so we're also doing all this stuff. So all of a sudden, we were getting a lot of calls from Asia that at the beginning, they weren't that many, from Europe, because, again, with everybody with different mix of drivers, but all of them wanting to reduce risk and manufacture closer to the U.S., right? And so, yeah, it has been an incredible opportunity. It's a huge wave that we're riding right now. And I think we're going to ride it for the next 15, 20 years. I don't see it being very short-lived.
Yeah, I think that all the factors you mentioned are definitely right there. I mean, you have the young population, more highly skilled than China. Costs at this point are probably lower than China, and also the less political risk. Just out of curiosity, I was wondering if you could talk about some of the industries your clients come from. Has that shifted at all since this rise in nearshoring? And do you have any anecdotes of clients talking to you about they used to outsource to China, but now they outsource in Mexico rather, and how, if there's anything like that, feel free to share it as well.
Yeah, the industries, I would say they're the same. You have automotive, which is number one on the list. There's a history of that. The USMCA, as part of the cocktail, it also had some criteria embedded there, some regulation that in 2023, I believe, or 2022, the threshold of regional contact had to be raised significantly. So that even created another big pool. You want to sell to Ford, you want to sell to GM, what you have to be in North America to make even matters more intense and nearshoring. And so automotive is a big, big part of this continued growth in nearshoring. And with the EV trend and the U.S. subsidies on EV with the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, and well, when I say not just the automotive subsidies, but all the clean energy that is promoted there and subsidized there, there are a lot of companies that seeking to access those subsidies want to become North American. And so again, you have automotive, and I'm putting the EV there. You have all these energy companies that in Matamoros, for example, which is close to where we have the majority of our operation, you have companies that do the wind farm equipment, but that it's very convenient to do it close to the border. We have clients that are in the electrical industry with transformers. You have medical devices has really grown a lot because a lot of the things that are sensitive and they don't want them to be done so far away as happened with the pandemic. People got scared, like all these medical equipment being done in Asia and in China specifically. So we've seen a lot of growth there, and mainly in Tijuana region and Ciudad Juarez, which are the two clusters. Aerospace continues to grow in the center of Mexico. And we have in our clients, we have clients that are exposed to automotive and they have seen a lot of growth, the two EVs. We have clients that are in the appliance industry, and appliances has also taken off. Again, it's not a new industry, but it has taken off. And one of the very surprising findings that we had, now it's not making the headlines because everybody knows about it, but when we started to notice that a lot of Chinese companies were coming to Mexico so that they could circumvent the tariff and they could continue to sell to U.S. clients as a Mexico company now, we started to see a lot of Chinese OEM come to Mexico. And when an OEM comes, it starts to attract all of these smaller suppliers. And those suppliers need other suppliers. And so it creates these very positive externalities. And we have seen a lot of that. For example, we have a client that does pole transformers, and they've been with us since 2019. And suddenly we got this call from one of their main suppliers, say, hey, these guys gave me your number. They want us to be in Mexico. Can you help us? Because we've never been to Mexico. Like, we need your help. And so we helped them. We set them up right across the street from their OEM. And now they have opened a distribution center in Monterrey. And now they're going to open their second manufacturing facility. Because once they were there, they started to see, well, why don't we sell to other clients here, you know, in Mexico, other maquiladoras. And so, wow, it's all these ripple effects that when a big player makes the move, it attracts a lot of other companies. And we've seen that in our company.
Sure. Yeah. It's really interesting how geopolitical changes can drive these shifts. I was talking to a Chinese friend recently who told me they're all moving to Monterrey now because they have to get around the tariffs and they all are moving to Mexico now. So it's pretty interesting. Would like to circle back to something you said earlier in the conversation about there are challenges of private equity in Mexico, and I guess also in your own search, it took you 3 years and had some trouble finding a business. So I was curious if those are the same challenges you faced when you were searching, and then also just what are the challenges of PE in Mexico in general?
Well, let me start with the search part. So I remember at one point, one of my US investors told me, like, what's happening in Mexico? Because I have 10 searchers in Mexico. And a lot of them are sending me the same deal. It's like, isn't this a country that has 180 million people in population? And you have a lot of cities. Like, how could you be sending me the same deal? And I'm sharing this story because, yes, Mexico is the 14th, if I'm not mistaken, economy in the world by size. Yes, we're 150 or 180 million. But the problem is that economic activity is heavily concentrated in Mexico City, in Monterrey, in Puebla, and in Querétaro. And so the companies that are search fund candidates are all really concentrated in these cities. And the searchers also all want to find companies in these cities, right? So it's not like in the US. I mean, you can be in Chicago, New York, in Miami, in Houston. Like, really, any city has the volume and the depth of the markets are incredible, right? And in Mexico, you don't have the same dynamic. And a lot of businesses in Mexico, unfortunately, when you start to look at them, there's a lot of skeletons in the closet because the tax code is very complicated. So a lot of companies to survive go around it. But by going around it, they do some shady stuff, which is not search fund material. You know, you're like, I'm not gonna buy this. This is gonna come and bite me. A lot of these companies are like a one man show, which is the owner. When the owner leaves, where's the team? Where's the company? What? And so, at the end of the day, my experience in Mexico was that it was a challenge to find quality companies to acquire, and also the most quality ones were coming through investment bankers. And one of the reasons was that these bankers would talk to the owners and tell them, like, if you want to sell your company, you got to get the house in order. So they would work probably like 12 months or more to get the information, to get everything in order, to get rid of liabilities. And so those were the companies that are probably were worth looking at. And that's why search funders were hitting on the same ones, because they were really the ones that make sense. But then I remember talking to my US investors, and they would say, well, no, we don't want to go through bankers. And I would say, well, but it's the thing is, in Mexico, it has a purpose to do it. And so with the search, I think a lot of it was that. And tying it to private equity, the private equity industry can see horrible return in Mexico. And I think one of the biggest issues is that there's not a sufficiently big and deep capital market to sell the company. Too few companies can go public. And so the exit is very small for these funds that grow these companies. And so some of these funds have bought companies, they've grown them, and then they can't sell them. They can't realize the gain, no? And so they're selling them between funds, one from to another fund. And so when you compare to how it works in the US, it's day and night, you know? And the capital markets in Mexico have not grown because we have legal constraints. And the legal constraints are also, they're tied to economic constraints. So it's a very complicated picture that has not allowed the economy to thrive. And tying it to what I see in nearshoring, unfortunately, this nearshoring window opened at a time where we have a federal government that is not business friendly. Right. So the tax regime is complicated. There's no promotion of business of Mexico outside of the country. And so managing a company in Mexico is very, very complicated. No, it's unfortunately, it is difficult. And if you add the FX risk at the very top, from the point of view of an international investor, it's like, oh, my God. Well, honestly, I would rather invest in the U.S. because I don't have the FX risk. I don't have the complexity to run the business with an unfriendly government. that is not really pro-business. And the market is not that deep. The middle class had been growing steadily in the past. But if you look at the numbers with this government, the middle class growth is really basically zero or negative. And so there's no purchasing power growth. And so, unfortunately, it's one of those things that academics have tried to understand and have debates all the time of, we are an emerging market in Mexico, but we have grown at levels of an industrialized economy for a very long time. And the reason, again, can be discussed, maybe because we're so tied to the U.S. economy, maybe structural. But the reality is, when you look at returns for private equity, they have been very, very bad.
And so interesting to see how it all ties together, government and legal and all of that leads to situations like this, which I guess you have to look at any emerging market you're considering. I guess just a couple more questions. One would be, if there are companies right now considering nearshoring their manufacturing, what advice would you have for them, or what message would you want to send to them?
When we talk about nearshoring, it's important to mention that we're not talking to the Procter and Gamble of the world, right? Or 3M, or these big, huge conglomerates. I mean, these guys, I mean, many of them have 10, 15 plants in Mexico since the 80s. You know, it's like, this is not what we're talking about. And by the way, those guys, for them, nearshoring has been, and I've heard it from many sources, they keep bringing assembly lines from Asia to Mexico slowly under the radar. And that's how they've been nearshoring. But that's another game. When we talk about nearshoring, it's these companies that sell up to $1 billion per year. A lot of them are family-owned, family-run, or private equity-backed. And there's a lot of them in the U.S. And these companies, they many times have never manufactured in Mexico, right? And so my first advice is, don't go at it by yourself. Mexico, it has a lot of virtues, like cultural affinity, especially on the north, on the border. It's very Americanized in many ways, same time zone, all that. But it remains a complex place to do business. So having a river guide like the Nearshore company, at least for the first 5 years, because that's what we sign for companies for 5 years, is the money better spent. Because we have heard stories and we have seen companies that come like, you know what? We underestimated this. And we went out there and thought like we were in Texas. And oh my God, we're not getting our tax return funds back, or they're closing, is the labor union is not letting us run the company. And all these nuances that obviously in 5 years, we've seen it many times, people become experts. I mean, and they can then, as we say, graduate and get their own maquila permit and nearshore on their own. But at the beginning, as with anything that you've never done, it's very, very useful to have a river guide that has your back, right?
Sure. I think that's definitely important. If someone's trying to move such an important part of their business operations to a totally different country, it would make sense to have someone who they can trust and can kind of smooth the process out for them. Was there anything else that you wanted to talk about or share?
I would say that this nearshoring thesis trend opportunity. I heard recently something that I'm going to quote in an event that's not mine, but this person was saying the nearshoring opportunity is so strong that even if Mexico does a very poor job, it's going to be great. And yes, it could be 10 times that. Yes. If. But really, the downside protection, to use a financial term, is still pretty high, no? So it's a unique opportunity that I do encourage search funders to look at models that are related to this thesis, because maybe I drank the Kool-Aid too much. I think that this is a structural trend, and we have seen it with our own eyes and in our own balance sheet and financial statements, and this happening, because I know there's a lot of that on the street, like, is nearshoring just a hype buzz, or is it happening? We've seen it happening. We hear it all the time, and it's going to be here for a while. So I do encourage some searches to happen on both sides of the border, where most of this activity is going on.
if you're comfortable sharing it, how much has your business grown in the past 5 years?
Well, I can share sort of a very high-level statistic. We've doubled the size of the company, and we've doubled the size of the company not only in revenues, but also in number of employees. We have close to 2,000 employees now. When we started, we had 7 facilities. Now we have 15 and clients and revenue. So yeah, in 4 years, we've doubled the size of the company.
Amazing. Well, yeah, super fascinating conversation. Thanks so much for joining, Jorge. I think a lot of people may be aware of nearshoring, but after they hear this, they're going to get even more excited. So thanks so much for joining and wish you the best of luck with your company. Hope it continues to grow 10x or even more.
Thank you so much, Nick. And I do hope that 10x that you mentioned does become a reality.
Sure. Sounds good.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the INSEAD Emerging Markets Podcast. To stay up to date on events we may be hosting, emerging market news, and to build your personal network, please feel free to join the INSEAD Alumni Emerging Markets Interest Group on LinkedIn.